Shalom Haravarnix. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. We're in session 16 at this time, dealing with the modern state, dealing with Israel present. So let's review where we have been last session. The last session we began by discussing the national water carrier, an above ground and underground conduit that spanned two-thirds the length of the country, bringing water from the north to the south and revitalizing and impacting Israel's water supply. So the national water carrier. In that same year, 1964, the Palestine Liberation Organization was formed. And we moved to 1967 and the Six-Day War. We saw that the Arab armies all massed on Israel's borders, Lebanon to the north, accompanied with Syria, Iraq, in the center of the country, Jordan, and in the south of the country, the Saudi Arabians, all on the east side of the of Israel's borders, and then Egypt on the west side of Israel's borders. Israel decided to do a preemptive attack to cripple the enemy, and the Egyptians had 19 airfields that needed to be dealt with. So exactly at 7:45 on the 5th of June, all of those airfields were hit by the Israeli Air Force, decimating the Egyptian Air Force. 1.5 hour after the aircraft attacked the Egyptian airfields, the Israeli army started across the Sinai. They first crossed on the 5th of June and then proceeded to sweep all the way across the Sinai Peninsula to the canal zone. So here's the center of the country. They have now of the Sinai Peninsula. They've secured the heart of the Sinai Peninsula, and then they also moved up the west coast of the Sinai Peninsula, securing the entire area. During that Six-Day War, Jerusalem was reunited. One of the most dramatic aspects of that war was the recapturing of the Western Wall. The paratroopers entered the old city through the Lion's Gate, and then they took a left turn under the entrances to the Temple Mount. Here are the IDF troops, the paratroopers, on the Temple Mount. Crossing the Temple Mount, they exited at the Mughrabi Gate, and now they were overlooking the prayer area, the holiest section, holiest site in Rabbinic Judaism. And we had a number of famous photographs comes out of this incident. Here are Israeli soldiers at the Western Wall. And the chief rabbi of the IDF was soon there, announcing the victory with the blowing of the shofar. Generals Eshkol, Dayan, and Rabin soon entered the old city, awestruck over the victory, over the reuniting of Jerusalem. The next aspect of the Six-Day War was the Golan Heights, conquering the Golan Heights. And that was done by June 10th, 1967. By June 10th, there was a new political entity in the Middle East. We had Israel proper in the light yellow, the occupied territories now in the light brown. So that was from the north, the Golan Heights, in the middle of the country, the West Bank, and to the south, the Sinai Peninsula. And that brings us to our new material for this session. We begin with UN Security Council Resolution 242. Now, on June 9th, the Communist Bloc leaders gathered in Moscow, where seven of them issued a long declaration of solidarity with the Arab cause, promising to help the Arab nations should Israel continue its aggression. Within the next few days, all the communist governments, except for Romania, severed relations with Israel. Bickering and belligerent incidents continued. The UN tried to hammer out an acceptable diplomatic formula for all sides. The result was in November 22nd of 1967, Resolution 242. Now, Resolution 242 contains three important provisions in regard to Israel and her neighbors. Number one, the Arab states are required to recognize the existence of the State of Israel and make peace. Number two, Israel's security needs are acknowledged. Any peace agreements with the Arabs must include secure and recognized borders that Israel can withdraw behind. These boundaries need not be the same as the lines drawn in the armistice agreements of 1949. And then number three, Israel can occupy and administer the territories that were conquered during a state of war. This occupation and administration can continue until peace agreements are recognized. Now, Resolution 242 does not require that Israel return to a state of military insecurity. Now, Arthur J. Goldberg was the sixth United States ambassador to the United Nations, and he led the delegation in the UN in 1967. Now, he submitted on May 8, 1973, he submitted an authoritative interpretation of the meaning of Resolution 242, explaining that the resolution is not self-implementing and that its goal is an accepted and agreed-upon settlement. Goldberg rejected the interpretation that the resolution calls for a complete Israeli withdrawal. He wrote, Resolution 242 does not explicitly require that Israel withdraw to the lines occupied by it before the outbreak of the war. Now, the Arab states urged such language. The Soviet Union proposed this at the Security Council, and Yugoslavia and some other nations at the special session of the General Assembly. But such withdrawal language did not receive the requisite support, either in the Security Council or in the Assembly. Resolution 242 simply endorses the principle of withdrawal, the withdrawal of Israel's armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict, and interrelates this with the principle that every state in the area is entitled to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries. Okay, so that's the results from the human perspective, the new geographic and political entity in the Middle East, and Resolution 242. There's a couple of results from a biblical perspective I'd like to share with you. First of all, we see in the Six-Day War that God empowered Israel, enabling her to survive a mortal threat, giving her the wisdom and the ability to survive a mortal threat. And secondly, as we look back, we see that God was moving in Jewish lives by bringing many Jewish people to faith during this time. Many of us in ministry today came to faith during this general time frame. So God was moving in the Jewish community in a mighty way in Israel, in America, and around the world. All right, let's move on. We'll move from UN Security Council Resolution 242 to the fact that the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine was founded. Here is the logo, the insignia of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. Now, the PFLP was founded by George Habash in December of 1967 in the wake of the Six-Day War. Throughout most of its existence, the organization combined Marxist ideology with Palestinian nationalism and was among the first of the Palestinian organizations to use terrorism as a means to win attention to its cause. The PFLP saw the elimination of Israel as a means toward the ultimate goal of ridding the Middle East of dictators who kowtowed to Western capitalism. In 1968, as we move 1 year down the time frame, that's when Yasser Arafat becomes head of the PLO. And here's, of course, a portrait of Yasser Arafat. He will be a major player in Israel's history until his death in 2004. All right, let's move to the War of Attrition in 1968. Troubles began to brew for Nasser following the defeat of the Six-Day War. Domestic unrest began to surface, and in October of 1968, there were riots. As Nasser saw it, vindication by war was one sure method of strengthening his hand within his own country. In fact, his hand already had been strengthened by the Russians, who viewed Israel's pulverizing victory in the Six-Day War as an intolerable challenge to their own leadership in the Middle East. So from the moment the ceasefire came into effect, the Soviets proceeded to reinstate large-scale arms deliveries to the Middle East. Within 2 weeks, over 200 crated MiG fighters were airlifted to Egypt and to Syria. Throughout the summer and the autumn, between two and three ships a week docked at the Alexandria harbor in Egypt, carrying replacement weapons. 15 months after the war, Egypt's tank strength had been increased from 250 to 470, and the Air Force had received 400 new planes. So they had more arms than ever at this point. A pattern of violence along the Suez Canal accordingly developed in erratic sequences. The initial phase, from the end of the war until April of 1969, was characterized by sporadic outbursts that grew in intensity and in frequency as the Egyptians recovered from their 1967 disaster. Each Egyptian probe from the west bank of the canal evoked a tough counterblow from the Israelis. The canal offered each side a first-rate defensive barrier. By autumn of 1968, a military standoff had developed. In October of 1968, there was a turning point in the rising crescendo of Suez fighting. On a single Saturday afternoon, a massive Egyptian artillery barrage killed 15 Israelis and demonstrated that Egypt had accumulated a vast superiority of men and equipment on the west bank of the canal. From then on, until late summer of 1969, the intensity of Egyptian shelling steadily mounted. The revived hostilities swiftly developed into an overt Egyptian war of attrition. Nasser's goal was to prevent the transformation of the canal into a de facto border, and to accomplish this by inflicting such heavy casualties that the Israelis would be forced back into the Sinai or compelled to accept a political solution on Arab terms. And here's a picture of Nasser with his generals at the Suez Canal, looking across the canal at Israeli positions. And here's an Israeli soldier on the Suez Canal looking at the Egyptian positions, looking back at each other over the Suez Canal. Now, the lethal Egyptian bombardment of October 1968 dictated a modified defensive approach. To that end, the Israelis began digging into hardened concrete and steel-reinforced bunkers and fortified positions. These were subsequently known as the Bar Lev Line, named after Israel's then chief of staff, Chaim Bar Lev. And here's one of those Bar Lev Line fortifications. And this is a close-up of one of those fortifications. With the completion of the fortifications in March of 1969, the Israeli general staff expected to be able to withstand the developing war of attrition. To reverse the heavy casualty trends, Israel, by late July 1969, launched a substantial bombardment of Egyptian guns on the west bank of the canal. For the next 3 months, Israeli planes battered away at the enemy emplacements, and gradually Egyptian positions along the waterway were silenced. Israeli losses dropped markedly. Then on January 22, 1970, Nasser paid an urgent visit to Moscow. He informed the Soviet leadership that the Israelis, in an effort to relieve pressure on the Bar Lev line, were now bombing Egyptian artillery emplacements west of the canal and also targets deep in the Nile Valley. A consequence of this far-reaching aerial activity was the evacuation of some 500,000 Egyptian civilians from the canal zone and the exposure of the Egyptian interior to Israeli incursions that were both militarily damaging and politically humiliating. A third of the Egyptian fighter force already had been shot down by enemy planes, and Nasser admitted that the morale of his troops had virtually collapsed. The Soviets agreed to participate more actively in defending Egyptian military and civilian targets. By mid-February, the Soviet airlift to Egypt had increased four times above its ordinarily high level. Within 6 months, the Russians had between 10,000 and 14,000 of their own instructors and advisors in Egypt, as well as an impressive naval flotilla of 60 vessels off the Egyptian coast. It was an armada that matched the U.S. Sixth Fleet in tonnage and surface firepower. Additionally, Soviet pilots were flying reconnaissance missions from Egyptian bases. Others were on interception alert at Egyptian fields, while Soviet units manned SAM-3 anti-aircraft missiles. And here's a Soviet-Egyptian SAM-3 battery. For Israel, the most crucial development was intelligence information that Soviet pilots were assuming responsibility for air defense over the Nile Valley. Accordingly, in April 1970, the Israelis suspended their deep penetration raids. The Egyptians, in turn, began moving new SAM missile batteries toward the canal. At the end of June 1970, Soviet aviators were flying combat patrols on both the northern and southern outlets of the canal. The Egyptian-Soviet defense system was further thickened with the introduction of SAM-4 and SAM-6 missiles. Before these new rockets were detected on June 30th, they managed to shoot down two Phantom Israeli Phantom jets. And here is the Phantom. This was a critical and important aircraft in the Israeli Air Force at this time. Early in July, they brought down an additional five Phantoms over the west bank of the canal. Now, the Israelis, as the Israelis encountered these Soviet tactics and a seemingly inexhaustible supply of enemy missile batteries, they recognized that they were facing their gravest military crisis since the week immediately preceding the 1967 war. By the end of July, Israel had suffered more than 3,000 casualties since the 1967 war. And there was also another side of the picture. The Egyptians had taken a fearful battering of their own. Since April 1970 alone, they had lost 10,000 casualties to Israeli air and artillery action. Now, Nasser died of a heart attack in September of 1970. The accession of Anwar Sadat allowed Jerusalem for the first time to anticipate a new and possibly more moderate stance. And here's the new president, Anwar Sadat. On May 27, 1971, came the revelation of a new and far-ranging treaty between Egypt and the Soviet Union. Early in 1972, agreement was reached between the U.S. and Israel on a continued supply to Israel of American Phantom jets and other sophisticated electronic equipment. By the spring of that year, the Israeli Air Force evidently had assured itself superiority not only over its Egyptian counterpart, but over the Soviet-Egyptian defense network. And this fact registered in Cairo. This accounted for mounting frustration in the Egyptian government, and eventually a crisis developed in relations between Sadat and the Kremlin leadership. Moscow's goal was a permanent military base in Egypt to be used for its own strategic and regional purposes. The Kremlin was not interested in direct military involvement with the conflict with Israel. They did not want their own Middle East Vietnam. Sadat was angered. He retaliated with an ultimatum July 13, 1972, telling the Soviets to withdraw their advisors and instructors. To the astonishment of both Washington and Israel, the Russians evacuated the largest part of their personnel from Egypt, and the war of attrition collapsed. Now, here's a summary of the War of Attrition from Martin Gilbert's Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. I will just read the information in this box to you. October 26, 1968, the Egyptians opened fire at Israeli positions on the east bank of the Suez Canal. 10 Israelis are dead. 31 October 1968, the first Israeli counter-raid. Israel begins construction of the Bar-Lev fortified line. March 1969, the Egyptians again open fire, and firing continues every few days. Also, Egyptian commando raids across the canal. July 1969, the Israeli Air Force begins raids on Egyptian military targets along the canal. And then in January of 1970, Israeli Air Force begins raids on military targets deep within Egypt. August 1970, Egypt and Israel finally agree to a ceasefire and no territory changes hands. All right, let's move to 1969, and Golda Meir becomes the prime minister. Just as David Ben-Gurion is the man most associated with the Yishuv, so Golda Meir is probably the woman most associated with the modern state of Israel. She was born Golda Mabovich in 1898 in Kiev, Russia, now called the Ukraine. Here is the town of Kyiv. And just south and west of Kyiv is the little town of Buki. So Golda Meir's family came from Kyiv, and my family came from Buki. In Kyiv, Aaron Cooperman was a bookkeeper and scribe, and in Buki, Meir Zolotushka was a horse trader. So her family immigrated to the United States in 1906 and took up residence in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Around that same time, my grandparents immigrated to the United States and lived in New York City, took up residence in New York City. This was probably a result of the Kishinev pogrom of 1903. Remember, the Second Aliyah began in 1904. So these families came over in the early 1900s, Golda's family in 1906. Now, this is a picture of Golda in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, young Golda Mavovich. She embraced Zionism in 1915 and eventually emigrated to Palestine in 1921 with her husband, Morris Meyerson. And they joined Kibbutz Merchavia. And here's a picture of Golda working in the kibbutz, in the fields of Kibbutz Merchavia. In 1934, she became the member of the executive committee of the Histadrut. The British attempted to crush the Haganah and Jewish resistance in 1946 by arresting leaders of the Yishuv, and as a result, Golda was chosen as the acting head of the political department of the Jewish agency. In this position, she was the principal Jewish representative negotiating with the British. She became well known for her unusually successful trip to the United States in January 1948, where she was able to secure generous financial aid from the U.S. Jewish community as she effectively presented Israel's struggle. During this period, she also engaged in a secret and dangerous, although unsuccessful, journey across the Jordanian border to meet with King Abdullah, hoping to convince him not to attack the newborn state of Israel. Her political career continued to rise after the establishment of the modern state of Israel. In 1948, she was appointed minister to Moscow. She held this post until April 1949. She was elected to the first Knesset in 1949 as a member of the Mapai Party. Minister of Labor was her first assignment. In 1956, she accepted an appointment as Israel's foreign minister, and this position catapulted her into international notoriety. She became the Secretary General of the Israel Labor Party, and in 1969, after the death of Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir became the fourth Prime Minister of Israel. She held that post until 1974. She resigned from the position in 1974 in response to criticism she received regarding Israel's lack of preparation for the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Golda Meir died 4 years later in 1978. And here is Golda Meir's grave on Mount Herzl. All right, let's move to that 1973 Yom Kippur War, where complacency characterized the country. Before we go any further, let me recommend a book, The Eve of Destruction by Howard Bloom. This book goes into details regarding the 1973 Yom Kippur War, and I think you'll enjoy reading it. All right, these bold-faced and self-congratulatory placards greeted the Israeli public as the elections for Israel's 8th Knesset drew near. There is peace on the banks of the canal and in the Sinai Desert, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, and the Golan. The lines are safe. The bridges are open. Jerusalem is united. New settlements have been established, and our political position is stable. This is the result of a balanced, bold, and far-sighted policy. And you know that only the labor alignment could have accomplished this. So these bits of political propaganda expressed a quite genuine mood of national security and prosperity. In the autumn of 1973, Israel's economy sustained its upward momentum. The GNP continued to grow at an annual rate of 10%, and employment opportunities were so widespread that even 130,000 Arab workers commuting from the administrative territories did not take up the slack. Evidence of the boom was everywhere to be seen: high-rise apartment buildings, luxurious new villas, a forest of television antennas, crowded shops, roads, and highways choked with 370,000 private vehicles in a population of less than 3 million. And all this in addition to unprecedented security at home. It's little wonder then that the electoral campaign that was taking place took place in an atmosphere so devoid of survivalist urgency as to border on complacency. In early September 1973, a new political party came into being. It was a right-center bloc entitled Likud, Unity, and was dominated by Menachem Begin. Now, on the military scene, self-assurance reflected and influenced Israel's military posture. Laxity began to taint all facets of the defense structure as well. The premier example was the Bar-Lev line. Here's again that picture of that portion of the Bar-Lev line. The Bar-Lev line had never been conceived as a barrier against full-scale invasion from Egypt. Its initial purpose was to serve merely as a tripwire that would activate reinforcements from bases and roads deep in the Sinai. At tremendous expense, some 30 major strongholds had been built along the canal at irregularly spaced intervals. The establishment of the Bar-Lev fortifications was sharply criticized by several respected army commanders. They said the Bar-Lev line would create in the army and in Israel at large a fixed defense philosophy. This approach was alien to the nation's tradition of mobility and retaliatory attack. Never such elaborate fortifications had been constructed, even to protect Israel itself, Israel proper. The dividing line between conceiving of the Bar-Lev line as an early warning outpost and as an early defense line gradually became blurred. It was this subsequent lack of clarity, with its mixture of fixed defense and tripwire concepts, that was to exact its toll in the first hours of October 6, 1973. Israeli self-assurance plainly was not weakened by the death of Nasser in September of 1970, or even less by the choice of Vice President Anwar Sadat as his successor. Now, this complacency was also reinforced by Anwar Sadat. Sadat's relaxed approach, his lack of interest in pan-Arabist adventures, and his involvement in essentially domestic concerns seemingly gave hope for peace in the Middle East. Yet for all his gracious demeanor and generosity, the new president was laying the groundwork for confrontation with Israel from the very onset of his presidency. For one thing, Egypt's economic needs, its population explosion, dictated the vital importance of opening the Suez Canal and rebuilding the canal cities. See, the War of Attrition had closed the canal. Thus, as early as October 1971, Sadat instructed his military command to prepare for crossing the canal. The president warned his countrymen the following May of 1972 that a showdown with Israel was inevitable and that he was prepared to sacrifice 1 million men in the forthcoming war. I wonder what those million men thought. Thanks a lot, President. That would be my thought. Thanks a lot. Putting me on the chopping block? Few in Israel gave heed to Sadat's warnings, particularly after July 1972, when he ordered the removal of Soviet advisors from Egypt. Sadat then embarked on building a common strategy within the Arab camp. He had little difficulty with President Hafez al-Assad of Syria. He wanted to go along with it. It was the expulsion of Soviet advisors from Egypt in July of 1972 that in the end strengthened Assad's hand. As a rebuke to Sadat, and in an effort to consolidate their position in the Middle East, the Soviets decided to ship unprecedented quantities of military equipment to Syria, including 300 new tanks, 300 MiG-21 fighter planes, and hundreds of late-model SAM-6 missiles. Indeed, Syria now became the most heavily armed nation per capita in the Arab world. Extensive plans were laid for a two-pronged attack under Egyptian strategic command. Sadat himself visited Damascus in May and in June to confirm these arrangements. Sadat also won over Faisal of Saudi Arabia and mended fences with Hussein of Jordan. He even won assurance of Soviet military backing. Throughout the summer of 1973, the Soviets accelerated their arms shipments to Syria and in the early fall embarked upon a massive new delivery program to Egypt. The shipments included substantial quantities of the latest anti-aircraft missiles, ranging from the highly mobile SAM-6 to shoulder-mounted SAM-7s, as well as limited numbers of Scud and Frog ground-to-ground missiles for attack against Israel's population centers. And here is a Scud missile on its launcher. And this is a Frog missile with its launcher, destined to be fired at Israeli population centers. Plans were made for a wartime airlift. In the week of October 6th, the Soviets launched five new Cosmos satellites into orbit to photograph Israeli defenses in the north and in the south. And by then, too, a Soviet electronics intelligence ship was sailing toward Egypt, and the families of Soviet advisors in Egypt and in Syria were being hastily evacuated. October 6 was decided upon as the most advantageous date. The Israelis would be preoccupied with their election campaigns, they would be worshiping and fasting on their holy day of Yom Kippur, and they would hardly expect an attack during the Muslim festival of Ramadan. Everything depended on simultaneous initiative and surprise. Now, the Israelis were by no means oblivious to the scope of these maneuvers, nor to the fact that large quantities of men and equipment were being accumulated along the waterway, along the canal. Neither did it escape them that in the north, the Syrians were methodically augmenting their tank and artillery forces in the triple lines of defense that had been constructed across the Golan plain to the outskirts of Damascus. For the time being, the Israeli general staff persuaded itself that these maneuvers and reinforcements were essentially defensive in nature. In the south, they interpreted them as yet another gambit in Sadat's annual war of nerves. And Sadat and his advisors did much to foster this illusion. For one thing, the Egyptian president had been announcing the moment of decision with such frequency during the past 2 years, it was difficult to take seriously any of the latest warnings. Now, in the last months of October, Sadat intensified his deception. He allowed reports to be circulated of growing tensions between Egypt and the Soviet Union, and of Soviet unwillingness to provide Egypt with new weaponry following the July 1972 expulsion of Russian advisors. And Israel believed these reports. On October 3rd, Prime Minister Golda Meir held a cabinet meeting with her defense and military commanders, Moshe Dayan, Yigdal Alon, Israel Galili, and others. The group agreed unanimously that war was not imminent. In fact, Israeli intelligence had all the necessary data on Arab preparedness and developments. The failure was in evaluation. Israel was relying on military electronic data provided by technicians. Modern electronic equipment could not replace scholarly analytical appraisal of the Arab mentality. The intelligence chiefs had made up their minds that Sadat and Assad would surely understand, as Israel understood, that a far-reaching offensive operation was unthinkable without dominant air power, and the Arabs were unlikely to have an effective bomber force for several years. This was the conception that inhibited a broader and more imaginative understanding of Arab frustration and vindictiveness. Reaction to the Arab concentration of forces came belatedly, indeed, not until October 5th, the eve of Yom Kippur. It was then, only when faced with overwhelming evidence of large-scale Arab preparations, that the General Staff agreed to declare an alert. At 4 a.m. the next day, Israeli and American monitors had intercepted the unmistakable radio signals of final Arab war preparations. Immediately, Dayan and General Elazar, the chief of staff, were notified and informed that zero hour evidently would come in 14 short hours. At 5 o'clock in the morning, 5 a.m., the general staff commanders were meeting in the defense ministry at Tel Aviv. Elazar requested full immediate mobilization and a preemptive airstrike. Diane turned him down, although he consented finally to recommend the mobilization of the Armored Corps reserve. 100,000 Armored Corps personnel began assembling. Fortunately, on Yom Kippur, it was possible to contact large members of reservists at their homes and in their synagogues. The roads were also clear of traffic. Even then, more than 24 hours would pass before all men reached their units. The men on the Bar-Lev line of the Suez Canal were ordered to withdraw to their fortifications and to keep alert, and they did it in a leisurely fashion, refusing to take seriously the notion of a major attack. Many of the troops were inexperienced young reservists. Large numbers of trained regulars had been given leave for Yom Kippur, another lethal blunder. From his headquarters in Nazareth, General Yitzhak Hofi, the Northern Front commander, issued orders for an alert. Hofi was denied authority to move his standing tank brigade forward, lest the Syrians regard this as a provocation. Again, the alert was observed laxly, reflecting the erosion of military discipline since 1967. At 2 p.m., the Israeli cabinet gathered in an emergency session, and a military aide suddenly entered the conference room and whispered urgently to Mrs. Meir, "The enemy onslaught had begun." And we'll begin with the Northern War with Syria. Now, it began with a vengeance. Thousands of shells and bombs exploded along the eastern bank of the canal and along the entire ceasefire line of the Golan Heights. Enemy planes roared overhead, strafing deep behind Israel forward positions. And here's a picture of four Sukhoi Su-7 fighter jets conducting air raids over the Bar-Lev line on the 6th of October. Israel quickly lost her radar surveillance fortification 6,000 feet up atop Mount Hermon. And here is the Mount Hermon surveillance station. You probably cannot see it in this picture, so we will go in as big an enlargement as we can make. There we go. And here is the Mount Hermon surveillance base. You can see some of the installation jutting up there above the mountain. So that was lost to the Syrians. It was an earthquake of an assault on the Golan. After a 55-minute artillery barrage, two Syrian armored divisions of 800 tanks and three infantry divisions in personnel carriers began rumbling across the ceasefire line. The hopelessly outnumbered Israeli defenders fought as if berserk, inflicting heavy losses but only delaying the steady advance. The Israelis were eventually reduced to six tanks. On the evening of October 8th, the Syrians unleashed another devastating artillery barrage, and a new force of 600 heavy tanks emerged from the smoke, followed by even larger waves of armored personnel carriers. The shadow of a new Holocaust descended upon Israel. However, as it developed, the Syrians, in the last effort, had expended everything. They were all out of supplies. They needed to be equipped badly. As Israeli reinforcements slowly began to crawl up the Golan, they began to maul the Syrian supply convoys with pinpoint gunnery. And here's a photograph of Israeli troops rushing up to the northern frontier, rushing up to the Golan in order to be reinforcements. So the Syrian supply convoys suddenly began turning their backs and running. That left the frontline troops without firepower, and they began to flee as well. The bludgeoned Israeli defenders shook off their exhaustion, managed to round up 20 tanks, and made mincemeat of the Syrian armor and personnel carriers as they pursued them. A handful of dazed and flogged youngsters, in a scattering of battered tanks, had lifted the shadow of certain catastrophe from the nation. On the 10th, the Israeli counterattack began. By early afternoon, precisely 4 days after the Syrians had launched their avalanche against Israel, not one of their tanks remained in fighting condition in Israeli territory. Strewn along the route of Israeli advance were 837 destroyed enemy tanks, over 3,000 personnel carriers, hundreds of anti-tank guns, and vast piles of military equipment. And here's a picture of some of that destroyed Syrian equipment. That's a personnel carrier, I think, in the foreground, and a Soviet tank in the background. The Syrians had thrown all they had into the offensive with every advantage of numbers, surprise, and equipment, and now the pride of the army lay smoking and ruined on the Golan. Full, if belated, mobilization had its effect on the northern front. By October 9th and 10th, Israel had forced the Syrians back to the initial ceasefire lines. Nevertheless, it was recognized that the Syrian army could not be allowed to recover and absorb equipment pouring in from the Soviet Union. On the evening of the 10th, the general staff agreed that it was necessary to penetrate at least 12 miles beyond the ceasefire line. And then, only then, could the Syrians be neutralized as a factor in the war. The 7th Armored Brigade was given the honors, and in less than 12 hours, the Syrians showed signs of breaking. By October 18th, Israel commanded the flat terrain extending to the outskirts of Damascus, only 22 miles away. And here's a map of the Yom Kippur War. In the north, we have the Golan Heights and the Syrian capital of Damascus. So in the beginning of the Yom Kippur War, the Syrians pushed over the ceasefire line deep into the Golan Heights. The Israeli response, although belated, was effective and eventually pushed the Syrians back to the ceasefire lines. And then Israel moved beyond the ceasefire lines and set their sights on Damascus itself. The suburbs of the city now lay within artillery range, and it was a good place to consolidate forces. Although Arab counterattacks were mounted each day thereafter against the Israeli wedge, the Jews launched no further offensive action against the Syrian capital. On the night of October 20th, orders were transmitted to recapture the heights at Mount Hermon, and this was accomplished by dawn of October 22nd. And again, here is that picture of Mount Hermon and the surveillance base. And soon the surveillance base was retaken, and Israel had regained their radar eyes. Now here is we'll now begin dealing with the southern war with Egypt. Here's a map of the area. The Egypt is on the left side of the map, and the Sinai Peninsula, Israeli-occupied territory, on the right side of the map. Now, 230 miles to the southwest, during the same grim hours of October 6th and 7th, the Israelis were tasting the power of one of the largest standing armies in the world. Positioned along the canal were five Egyptian infantry divisions, three mixed infantry and tank divisions, 22 infantry commando and paratroop brigades. With the Air Force, the enemy consisted of not less than 600,000 soldiers, 2,000 tanks, 2,300 artillery pieces, 160 SAM batteries, and 550 combat airplanes. Now, facing this war machine in the Sinai, along 110 miles of the canal, were precisely 436 Israeli soldiers. They were in a series of 30 fortified bunkers, 7 to 10 miles apart, together with 3 tanks and 7 artillery batteries. Very lopsided in favor of Egypt, isn't it? By 2 p.m. on October 6th, as Sadat's planes attacked air bases and radar stations behind the Israeli lines, the full weight of Egyptian artillery opened up along the entire front, including volleys of long-range Frog missiles. For the next 53 minutes, the skeletal Israeli contingent on the East Bank fortifications endured murderous shelling. Then, when the barrage ended, the first wave of 8,000 Egyptian infantry moved across the waterway in fiberglass boats. And here's a drawing of Egyptian troops crossing the Suez Canal. There was little that the shell-shocked Israeli reservists in the fortifications could do to halt the crossings. By nightfall, no fewer than 30,000 Egyptian infantrymen had attained a foothold throughout the eastern length of the canal. Some units had pushed forward to a depth of 3 miles. That night, and here's a map of the incursion, the Egyptians had now pressed forward into the Sinai Peninsula. That night, 11 pontoon bridges went up across the water and tanks began moving over. Here's a picture of one of those pontoon bridges. Within 24 hours of the initial offensive, 5 Egyptian infantry and armored divisions had taken up positions 3 miles east of the canal, entirely outflanking the Barlev line, which they anticipated taking at their own convenience. Now, it was a remarkable achievement. General Shazly had expected his army to suffer as many as 10,000 casualties. Instead, Egyptian dead in the first stage totaled 180 men. As the Israelis withdrew, the Egyptians turned their attention to the remnants of the Barlev fortifications. 5 had been overrun at the outset, 6 had been evacuated, and only 9 bunkers continued to hold out. At headquarters, staff officers wept, aware that all rescue efforts would now be futile. And here's an example of an Israeli M60 Patton tank that had been destroyed in the Sinai by this initial assault. So the defenders were given permission to surrender. All but one of them did. The position at Port Fuad held out until the end of the war. Early in October 9th, the Israeli counterattack on the southern sector had begun. Israeli forces were resuming their traditional coordination and flair. However, this initial attempt to destroy the Egyptian foothold failed with heavy losses. Thus, on October 10th, the battle lines stabilized, with Israel holding its own on the Golan and the Egyptians temporarily digging in east of the canal. So here are the Israelis. They're holding their own on the Golan, and the Egyptians are digging in to the east of the canal. At this time, 70,000 enemy troops had crossed the waterway and established an unbroken front 6 miles in depth. By October 14th, the Israelis had reinforced their strength with 430 tanks. Dawn on the 14th was preceded by a 90-minute artillery bombardment, and then the Egyptians launched their full strength eastward. The Israelis saw a huge cloud of dust moving toward them. The battle lasted over half a day. It was a slaughter. Over 250 Egyptian tanks were destroyed within the first 2 hours of the combat. When the Egyptians attempted to bring infantry forward with their armor, hundreds of their personnel carriers were liquidated. The expert Israeli tankers then cut off the retreat of the Egyptian stragglers, knocking out another 55 tanks without a single loss of their own. The firing died down by 3 p.m., and Israel had won an armored victory that exceeded Montgomery's triumph over Rommel in World War II. Now, in addition, a seam had opened up between the Egyptian Second Army in the north and the Third Army in the south. By coincidence, and I think it's probably a divine coincidence, this seam coincided with a staging area that Ariel Sharon had prepared years earlier. This staging area had been developed in 1968 as part of Israeli preparations to counterattack across the canal if that was needed. The crossing was authorized and dubbed Operation Gazelle. Ariel Sharon would take the brigade across. And here's Chaim Barlev in the center. He's consulting with Ariel Sharon, who has the bandage on his head, and with Moshe Dayan with his cap. Here are the three generals consulting about the crossing. Now, the crossing went poorly. The idea was that Sharon would take the lead. Then Adon's forces from the north would join him, followed by Magan's forces from the south. And again, the crossing went rather poorly. By 9 a.m. on October 15th, a mere 30 tanks and 2,000 men had reached the west bank of the canal. However, the Egyptian command, when informed of this small number, assumed that a small Israeli raiding party was running loose. nothing more. And they didn't react. So it's in God's providence that even a poorly executed military maneuver worked to Israel's advantage. The Egyptians did nothing. By October 17th, Israeli tanks had fought their way to the crossing point, and pontoon bridges were erected, and Israeli tanks began to rumble en masse into Egypt. And here are the Israeli tanks crossing the canal. Only then did Cairo wake up to the fact that Sharon's initial small crossing was more than just a raid. Israeli army began systematically destroying Egyptian missile batteries and tearing holes in the Egyptian air defenses. The divisions ground ahead at full tilt through the Egyptian Third Army's West Bank supply lines. And so here was Operation Gazelle. Sharon led the attack, his forces crossing first. Adon's forces followed and then turned south toward the city of Suez. That was followed by Magan's forces, who turned to the east and decimated supply lines. In the morning of October 22nd, the UN approved a Soviet and American appeal for a ceasefire to go into effect in 12 hours. Israel accepted the ceasefire on the same day, as did Jordan and Egypt. The ceasefire deadline found the Egyptian Third Army hopelessly trapped, with its supply lines cut and large members of its troops fleeing in disorder. 8,000 were already prisoners. Under these circumstances, the Egyptians ignored the ceasefire proclamation and struck repeatedly at the Israelis in an effort to open up an exit corridor. A new ceasefire was proposed for October 24th. It was accepted, and Israel fought up to the last moment. When the fighting stopped, three divisions had penetrated 25 miles into Egypt, dominating the southern half of the West Bank. On the East Bank, Egyptian forces were deployed along the Dabar Lev line to a depth of 3 to 5 miles. So here is the situation. We have Israel proper, the light yellow. We have the 1967 occupied territory in light brown. Then we have the 1973 Egyptian territory in red. And the 1973 Israeli territory in dark brown. In the last analysis, the Israeli armored force had won the most striking victory in their history. It's worth recalling that the combined Arab forces actually had launched their offensive with more troops and weapons than those available to NATO, the North American Treaty Organization that existed in Europe. And all this, more troops and weapons than those available to NATO, against a small country with a population unready and an army unmobilized. And despite the fury of the war, despite the surprise attack on two fronts, the incomparable Arab power and military equipment, Israel had held out, and eventually its forces had penetrated well beyond the enemy's borders. My only comment to that, God is in charge. He defeats Israel's enemies. The Egyptians had suffered 7,700 combat dead and the Syrians 3,500. The Israelis held 9,000 POWs, among 8,000 were Egyptian. The combined Arab forces had lost 2,000 tanks, over 500 planes, compared to Israel's losses of 804 tanks and 114 planes. Israel lost some 2,552 dead and over 3,000 wounded in the 18 days of fighting. And strategically, little was accomplished. Both sides eventually withdrew to approximately the same lines that existed before the war. David Ben-Gurion died in that year, 1973. On November, 87-year-old David Ben-Gurion was stricken with a cerebral hemorrhage in his desert kibbutz of Sadeh Boker. He was rushed to Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. After lingering 2.5 weeks, he died on December 1st, 1973. And here is David Ben-Gurion's grave alongside his wife at their kibbutz of Sadeh Boker. In 1975, UN Resolution 3370 9 came to pass. Zionism is racism. In early July 1975, the UN International Women's Year Conference in Mexico City issued a declaration sponsored by 77 non-aligned, quote-unquote, countries, calling for the elimination of Zionism as one of the world's great evils, along with colonialism, neocolonialism, imperialism, foreign domination and occupation, apartheid, and racial discrimination. The Third World Offensive had only begun. If the Arabs and their supporters failed in the summer of 1975 to evict Israel from the United Nations, they accomplished essentially the same objective, that of isolating Israel diplomatically. On November 10, 1975, barely 28 years after voting to establish a Jewish state, the UN General Assembly endorsed a resolution describing Israel as, quote, a racist regime in occupied Palestine, and stigmatizing Zionism as a form of racialism and racial discrimination. This is hypocrisy to the max, because it was fine for the Arab states to be created. It's fine to have an Arab state, but to have a Jewish state, that's horrible, that's terrible, that's racial and racially discriminatory. The Arab states are not, but the Jewish state is. Hypocrisy to the max. The resolution's preamble opposed this infamous act, but the resolution was approved by a vote of 72 to 35 with 32 abstentions. On December 5th, the Assembly went so far as to order Israel to return all occupied Arab land without qualification, that is, without qualification of peace treaties, and to restore the so-called legitimate rights of the Palestinians. In the 1980s, Israel experienced a steady improvement in international standing, and as the Madrid Peace Conference approached, and we'll talk about that soon, as the Madrid Peace Conference approached, Israel conditioned UN participation in the peace process on the revocation of General Assembly Resolution 3379, that Zionism was racism, and this was done on December 16th, 1991. The resolution was rescinded. All right, at this point, it would be a good time for you to view the DVD, Israel, A Nation is Born, Part 4, 1967 to 1973, by Foreign Minister Abba Iban. It would be a great time for you to watch that. And also, watch Against All Odds Program 8, A Warrior Named Kalahani. A Warrior Named Kalahani. All right, let's finish up with our last couple of minutes here with Operation Entebbe. Operation Entebbe was a counter-terrorist hostage rescue mission carried out by commandos of the Israeli Defense Forces at Entebbe Airport in Uganda on the 4th of July, 1976. A week earlier, on the 27th of June, an Air France plane with 248 passengers was hijacked by members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, and the German Revolutionary Cells, and flown to Entebbe, the main airport of Uganda. And here's an Airbus A300. This is the type of aircraft that was hijacked. The local government supported the hijackers, and dictator Idi Amin personally welcomed them. The hijackers separated the Israelis and Jews from the larger group and forced them into another room. That afternoon, 47 non-Israeli hostages were released. The next day, 101 non-Israeli hostages were allowed to leave on board an Air France aircraft. More than 100 Israeli and Jewish passengers, along with the non-Jewish pilot, Captain Bakos, remained as hostages and were threatened with death. The IDF acted on intelligence provided by the Israeli intelligence agency Mossad. When the hijackers threatened to kill the hostages if their prisoner release demands were not met, and this threat led to the planning of a rescue operation. These plans included preparation for armed resistance by Ugandan military troops. The operation took place at night. Israeli transport planes carried 100 commandos over 2,500 miles to Uganda for the rescue operation. So here is Israel to the north, and south of Israel, in the heart of Africa, lies Uganda. And the rescuers had to fly 2,500 miles in order to accomplish this operation. The operation took a week of planning and lasted some 90 minutes. 102 hostages were rescued. 5 Israeli commandos were wounded, and 1, the unit commander, Lieutenant Colonel Yonatan Netanyahu, was killed. And here's the Entebbe commander, Lieutenant Colonel Yonatan Netanyahu. All the hijackers, 3 hostages and 45 Ugandan soldiers were killed, and 30, some say only 11, Soviet-built MiG-17s and MiG-21s of Uganda's Air Force were destroyed. Kenyan sources supported Israel, and in the aftermath of the operation, Idi Amin issued orders to retaliate and slaughter several hundred Kenyans present in Uganda. What a brutal guy. Operation Entebbe, which had its military code name Operation Thunderbolt, is sometimes referred to retroactively as Operation Yonatan in memory of the unit's leader, Yonatan Netanyahu. He was the older brother of Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister of Israel. And this would be a good time for you to watch Program 12 of Against All Odds, Rescue at Entebbe. All right, we've run out of time for this session, so we'll pick it up next session in 1977 when the Likud comes to power in Israel. So again, thanks for being our students. We're always glad when you join us for these sessions. We'll see you next session. Lahitraot. Lahitraot.